It's the dawn of a new era. The United Kingdom has a new king, Charles III, after the death of Britain's beloved Queen Elizabeth II. Live from London, a special edition of This Week starts right now.
I declare before you all that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service.
A seminal moment for the United Kingdom and the world as the 70-year reign of Queen Elizabeth II comes to an end.
She was the rock on which modern Britain was built.
She showed the world how to give, how to love, and how to serve.
We will remember the values she never ceased to embody, the moral fortitude of democracy and freedom.
And historic friend of the United States, a champion of democracies around the globe.
The Atlantic unites, not divides us. Ours is a partnership, always to be reckoned with, in the defense of freedom and the spread of prosperity.
The thoughts and prayers of the American people are with the people of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth in their grief.
Prince Charles becomes King Charles III, the weight of the monarchy now on his shoulders.
As the Queen herself did with such unswerving devotion, I too now solemnly pledge myself to uphold the constitutional principles at the heart of our nation.
What's ahead for America's closest ally, and how will this seismic shift shape things back home? We cover all the angles this morning with the U.S. Ambassador to the U.K., Jane Hartley, Maggie Rooley at Balmoral Castle, Amy Robach in Scotland, and Ian Hannell and James Longman here outside Buckingham Palace.
From ABC News, this is a special edition of This Week. Reporting live from London, co-anchor Martha Raddatz.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. We join you this morning from London, where a nation in mourning has welcomed a new king while preparing to say goodbye to its longest reigning monarch. There's the coffin bearing Queen Elizabeth II, the procession departing for Edinburgh a short time ago from Balmoral Castle in Scotland, where she died Thursday. Buckingham Palace has announced 10 days of commemorations for the Queen, culminating in a state funeral to be held at Westminster Abbey next Monday. President Biden has confirmed he will be attending. Yesterday, the Queen's son, King Charles III, was officially proclaimed Britain's new sovereign in an historic ceremony that was televised for the first time. He paid tribute to his mother's seven-decade reign and earlier pledged lifelong service to Britain in his first address as monarch. Members of Parliament also took their oath of allegiance to the new king yesterday, who now faces the difficult task of balancing tradition with progress, his own ideas of the monarchy, and steadying a family rocked by recent upheavals. His sons William and Harry and their wives coming together for the first time since June.
You've got opinion.
This morning, we'll reflect on the Queen's remarkable life, her unparalleled legacy, and the challenges ahead for the new king as the end of the second Elizabethan era further deepens a period of uncertainty and anxiety for the kingdom Charles now leads. Our coverage begins with Amy Robach in Edinburgh, Maggie Rooley at Balmoral Castle. We'll start with Maggie. Good morning, Maggie.
Hi, good morning, Martha. Yeah, we were standing right here watching as the Queen's coffin made its way down this road, leaving Balmoral Castle for the final time. And just knowing that she'll never be back here in this place that she so loved, often called her favorite, it was emotional. And we saw through the car windows Princess Anne, and the look of pure grief and heartache on her face was a reminder that this moment isn't just about a nation grieving for their queen, but also about a family grieving for their mother, their grandmother, their great-grandmother. Now, as her coffin right now is making its way to Scotland through those backcountry roads, more than 100 miles, stopping in small Scottish towns, we're seeing such an outpouring of love, thousands and thousands of people coming out to line the streets. And Martha, what's been so striking being up here in Balmoral for the last few days is witnessing this special relationship that the royal family has with the community here. We've spoken with so many that call them their neighbors, say things like, you know, the then Prince Charles walked into the local bakery to buy a loaf of bread, or they would see the Queen driving herself around town, giving the locals a wave. As one woman put it, she said, you know, right now we're not just grieving the death of a queen, we're grieving the death of a neighbor. And I think, Martha, that as we see this outpouring of grief and love today in Scotland, it's really just a glimpse of the outpouring of grief and love we're going to see throughout the entire week to come.
That's true. We will. Thanks, Maggie Rooley. Let's bring in Amy Robach, who's in Edinburgh. And Amy, the Queen's arrival there sets in motion nearly 10 days of public tributes leading to her state funeral next Monday.
That's right, Martha. And Buckingham Palace has announced that the Queen her funeral will again take place next Monday, September 19th. And ahead of that, there is a significant amount on the schedule for the royal family. We know that the Queen's coffin is on the way. We've just been showing you to Holyrood House. That's right here in Edinburgh, just a short distance from where I'm standing right now. That is the official residence of the monarchs when they're in Scotland. And it will remain there until tomorrow afternoon. And I can tell you firsthand, we have seen barricades. We have seen those gates up along the street, an increased police presence as well in anticipation of the crowds that are expected to be here. Now, tomorrow there will be a procession along what's called the Royal Mile. That is headed to St. Giles Cathedral, which is a short distance down here. Members of the royal family are expected to be there, including the king, to receive the coffin and to allow people to pay their respects. She will lie in rest here in Scotland for that period of time. And again, the people who have come here, who live here, will be able to pay homage to the Queen. Now, on Tuesday, the Royal Air Force is going to fly her coffin to Buckingham Palace, accompanied by Princess Anne. She will then lie in state at Westminster Hall for 4 days. This will be open to the public, so people there in London will also be able to pay their respects, and the crowds are expected to stretch for miles and miles, as you might imagine, people coming to London to see the Queen finally. And then once again, that official state funeral will take place a week from Monday. And the mourning period, of course, will continue until then. Martha.
And Amy, I really am thinking of King Charles. The new king really is balancing the mourning of his mother with his new official responsibilities this week.
And he has a significant amount of responsibilities. He is very, very busy. He will be at Buckingham Palace today. He's going to be addressing Parliament at Westminster Hall tomorrow, of course, taking on those kingly duties. Then he will make his way right here to Edinburgh, as I mentioned. A lot of people anticipating that, having the king come to this city. And he will, again, be leading that prayer service at St. Giles Cathedral, Martha.
Thanks very much to you, Amy, and to Maggie. Thanks to both of you this morning. People from around the world have gathered here outside Buckingham Palace to pay their respects to Her Majesty, a familiar face to millions around the planet. The massive crowds and the breadth of tributes from global leaders, another reminder of Queen Elizabeth's outsized legacy.
For seven decades, Queen Elizabeth guided Britain through a remarkable arc of history. From the post-war European recovery through a new millennium, preserved throughout the pomp, the grandeur that helped keep the monarchy relevant. But Queen Elizabeth was not all about ceremony. As head of state, making more than 270 foreign trips, and back home, working with 15 different British prime ministers. Just days ago, greeting the newest prime minister, Liz Truss.
The United Kingdom is the great country it is today because of her.
Queen Elizabeth's 70 years of leadership, the stability of Britain, helping to shape the strong ties between the UK and the US, meeting 13 sitting US presidents. She was the first monarch to ever address the US Congress.
I want to take this opportunity to express the gratitude of the British people to the people of the United States of America.
The Queen was also head of the Commonwealth, 56 independent countries, accounting for nearly a third of the world's population.
The Queen was the first reigning sovereign to set foot on Australian soil.
But through these years, the Queen confronted the reality of progress and change outside and within the monarchy.
Institutions which in turn must continue to evolve if they are to provide effective beacons of trust and unity to succeeding generations.
That mantle now on the shoulders of her son, Now, King Charles III, who is pledging to carry his mother's legacy forward.
My mother's reign was unequaled in its duration, its dedication, and its devotion. I am deeply aware of this great inheritance and of the duties and heavy responsibilities of sovereignty, which have now passed to me.
The new king spent much of his lifetime preparing for the job, from charity work to surprise visits to British troops abroad and efforts to combat climate change. But today, at a time of instability in Britain, growing polarization and questions about the relevancy of this constitutional monarchy, King Charles faces enormous challenges without the domestic popularity and global embrace that his mother held dear.
We are joined now in London by the U.S. Ambassador to the United Kingdom, Jane Hartley. It is good to see you this morning, Madam Ambassador.
Good to see you, Martha.
Britain, of course, our closest ally. We've had prime ministers come and go, but the Queen was really the stability. President Biden calling it unmatched dignity and constancy. How significant do you see this loss?
Oh, I see it as very, very significant. When it was announced on the television, I happened to be at Winfield House, which is the home of the U.S. ambassador, and my staff and my team were there, both Americans and U.K. Everybody immediately burst into tears. She truly was a part of everybody's life. Everybody talked about where they had met her or where they had seen her. You know, she was very much out in the community. Children, grandchildren, parents, she was loved. And it was 70 years. First prime minister was Winston Churchill and the last Liz Truss.
And you've been here just since May, but you did have a chance to meet the Queen.
I did, and she was absolutely wonderful. It was actually, I presented credentials at Buckingham Palace to her. It was the hottest day in London history. A horse-drawn carriage was supposed to pick me up, but they called right before saying it was too hot for the horses. So she sent a car, her own car, to get me, which was so gracious. In our audience, you know, she was very substantive, so there was a lot of, obviously, policy discussed. But she really cared about, was I happy? Had I fit into London? Was I being welcomed? I told her I brought my dog, and that made her very happy.
Lots of policy to discuss. What kinds of things did you discuss in terms of policy?
Well, you never talk about an audience with the Queen, but what I will say is, you know, she was interested in foreign policy, all of the issues. You know, obviously the UK and the US are working so closely together, particularly on Ukraine. She actually asked a lot of questions about our domestic politics, and she was unbelievably informed and always gracious and warm.
She was enormously popular, but the polls have shown that Charles doesn't quite have that capital. So how does he navigate this going forward?
Well, you know, I think that he's both a link to the past and a bridge to the future. And I think if you watched his speech, his inaugural speech, is what we would call it, he touched everything perfectly. He touched his love for his mother, but also his love for the country and his sense of duty to the country. And I think she instilled him in that. And then I think he, too, has been preparing for this role for many, many years, and he's been out in the community. So I think it will be interesting what he does, because I think he will be a bridge to the future.
The Queen's death comes at a time of great uncertainty here in the United Kingdom, a brand new prime minister after some upheaval. You've got inflation here. Do you have concerns about the UK?
No, I have no concerns about the UK. Our special relationship is truly special. They are our most important ally in the world. And as we see, in particular, what we're doing on Ukraine together, and there's a seamless sharing of information, our military, our security. There's a huge amount of trust. We work really, really well together.
The Queen did not talk about politics, certainly in public. King Charles has been more outspoken, actually. Prince Charles was more outspoken. King Charles, not so much yet. But What do you expect? Can he be more outspoken? Is that the future?
On that question, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was interesting in his speech that he said all of the charities that had been so committed to, he was obviously no longer going to do. So I think, at least initially, he will follow his mother's example. But he does care deeply about a lot of these issues, especially young people, which I have the deepest respect for him for doing.
And just very quickly, you and I were talking briefly beforehand. What is the fascination with Americans about the royals? Is it just the soap opera of it all, or is there something deeper?
I think, obviously, there is a soap opera, but I think there's more than that. I think it's the dedication that the Queen had to an institution and to a country. And she had that dedication for 70 years. You just don't see that much in politics these days. And I think Americans really respected it.
They seem to. Thanks so much for joining us.
Right there.
This morning.
Great to see you.
As we noted, Queen Elizabeth famously never publicly revealed what she really believed, who she liked, who she didn't like. She was a constitutional monarch who stayed above the fray and out of politics. But as Charles takes the throne, could the new monarch bring a different approach to his reign? Joining us now is James Longman, our foreign correspondent, and ABC News royal contributor Andrew Morton, who has published several biographies of the Queen. Thanks very much for joining us this morning, gentlemen. I want to start with you, James. You have taken note of this all week. She was the Queen as much of an institution as the monarchy itself. What was her biggest mark on the country, from your view?
I feel her biggest mark was that she tried very hard not to make too much of a mark at all. She was a constant force for stabilization during, you know, decades of political and social upheaval, and she was kind of a sponge for the nation's emotions. So I feel like I feel very keenly that that was her greatest contribution. But also, she managed to take monarchy from the age of empire into the 21st century. She did bring us into her home with television cameras. She was the first to do that. She was the first to do walkabouts, meeting the public. We're seeing Charles in the image of his mother in that respect. But I think, over and above everything, it was her ability to show she felt something, but not tell us what she thought about anything.
What else did she affect, Andrew? I know she didn't want to make that mark and be about her, but what else did she affect in day to day?
Well, I mean, she was part of our lives. She was impregnable, she was immutable, she was like the White Cliffs of Dover. Her very existence gave comfort in a chaotic world. And I think that one of the aspects of her that we neglect is that she was an archetypal mother. And we saw that when Diana died. People wanted their mother, as it were, to come back and comfort them. And I think that was an understated but a very important part of her duties.
But she did have this weekly meeting with prime ministers. Do we have any idea what went on in that? Any idea discussed?
I mean, it's very interesting, but both Liz Truss and the King Charles III are seasoned old pros. They've been around the block a few times, so they'll know what's expected of them. A big contrast when a young Queen Elizabeth II first met her first Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, who she was dumbstruck in his presence, and he was sobbing because of his presence with monarchy. They eventually became great friends and great confidants, but it took a long time, and it will be exactly the same with Truss and the King, that the Prime Minister will be, and the new monarch will be feeling each other out, seeing what interests them and what intrigues them.
And James, did her gender impact her influence? This 25-year-old young woman in a man's world, very much a man's world.
I think it did. I don't think she would have felt... She would absolutely not have said that she was a feminist. She was above the political fray. That wasn't her style. She absolutely wasn't a campaigner the way her son has been throughout his tenure as the Prince of Wales. And obviously, that's got to change. But if you think about some of Britain's best and greatest monarchs, many of them have been women. I mean, I'm thinking of Elizabeth I and Victoria. And I think womanhood does play a role in this. I think there is a power in that. But the very fact of her gender not really meaning anything for the role was somehow powerful in and of itself. Look, we looked past the fact that she was a woman and she was just this great, great monarch.
And speaking of monarch, the world has changed quite a bit. What does Charles have to do to keep the monarchy relevant or survive.
Well, that's a very good word. He's got to use the capital that's been left by the Queen to make the monarchy more inclusive, more and relevant to modern Britain. So, for example, he's going to have to really embrace all faiths in Britain. He's talked about being the defender of faith, not just the faith, not just the Protestant faith. So there's that. So, and I can quite see over the next few months he'll be visiting Hindu temples and so on to really make that message known around the country.
James, do you see him becoming more outspoken?
Absolutely not. I think we got that from his address. He's quite clear that everyone expects that of him and he doesn't want to be that person. But I think we know a lot more about this king than we ever did, obviously, about the Queen. The Queen was able to close the door before the cameras started rolling, and Charles was on the other side of that door. We've known everything about him for the last 73 years. But what I would say is that he's very plugged in a way people don't realise. The Prince's Trust has helped something like 900,000 young people get real jobs. It's not just charity for charity's sake. He understands social issues in this country. So making the monarchy relevant to that point, I think he's actually better placed to do that than his mother was.
And just a final question to you both. Let's start with you, Andrew. Queen Elizabeth stood for, as people say, decency, tolerance, humility. So how would you answer that in regards to King Charles?
King Charles III, service, with a capital S. And he's pledged his life to service. And that's what we're going to see over the next few years. We're not going to see a man dabbling in politics. He'll leave that to his second-in-command, Prince of Wales, Prince William. He'll be the one who does the heavy political lifting there.
And James?
He understands the power of the team. He's always understood it. He knows William is very popular. He knows Kate. I mean, that's why it's so important on who marries who in this family. Kate really is now arguably one of the most popular members of the royal family, if not the most popular member. So the team, he'll know the team is important.
Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
There's much more ahead this morning from London, but first, major developments in the war in Ukraine, Russian forces suddenly in disarray and retreat. Ian Pannell joins us with that, plus the roundtable weighs in on all the week's politics and, of course, the story here in Britain that has drawn the world's attention.
This is BBC News from London. Buckingham Palace has announced the death of Her Majesty.
We are coming on the air with somber news from Buckingham Palace. Queen Elizabeth II has died.
Kent, the UK longest serving monarch, has died at a bumble aged 96.
C'est maintenant tout à fait officiel. Laura, on vous retrouve.
نبأ وفاة إليزابيث الثانية ملكة.
The Queen served her nation throughout the Commonwealth, but she touched people around the world.
The impact of her death will reverberate across the Commonwealth and the world.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tributes from around the world and a look at the White House flag at half staff in honor of Queen Elizabeth II, who was following global events right to her last days, including the war in Ukraine, which took a significant turn this weekend after a lightning advance from the Ukrainians liberated a strategically important city in the northeast and could stop Russia's goal of taking eastern Ukraine. Here's ABC's Tom Sufi Burge now with the latest.
This week, a major breakthrough for Ukraine in the northeast. Its forces advancing quickly through the Russian lines. Wrecked Russian vehicles lining the roads. Russian forces caught off guard, apparently in disarray.
Церемонія підняття державного прапора, приступіть.
Ukrainian troops liberating cities and the Ukrainian flag flying once again. A senior Ukrainian official telling ABC News the operation was thoroughly planned and everything was running to schedule. And overnight, President Zelensky saying his forces have liberated over 700 square miles of territory in just the past 10 days, claiming Russian troops were running away, calling it a good choice. And this, the biggest prize so far, Ukrainian forces entering the strategically important city of Izium. Without Izium, Putin's goal of capturing all of Ukraine's neighboring eastern Donbass region will be even harder. In newly liberated villages, Ukrainian police digging up bodies. Fresh war crimes investigations now underway. This week, Ukrainian military command saying drones are playing a crucial role in counter-offenses in the east and the south.
We're with a Ukrainian reconnaissance unit just outside Zaporizhia. And these guys' main job is to work out where the Russian positions are so they can call in the strikes.
And this morning, a real sense of crisis at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. The last remaining reactor shut down overnight. Shelling in the area cutting off the last remaining external power supply. So the plant is now only stable because of diesel generators and the risk of a nuclear catastrophe real. The UN's nuclear watchdog, with officials now based at the plant, with this desperate appeal.
A nuclear power plant can never be a pawn of war. Its fate must not be decided by military means.
Yeah, Martha, what's striking about this advance is the speed at which the Ukrainian military has been taking territory. It also seems that the Ukrainians have captured a ton of abandoned Russian military equipment and ammo, another sign that the Russians left in a hurry. This is a protracted war. It probably has a long way to run, but this is a really big moment. Martha?
Tom Sufi Burge in Ukraine. Thanks to him. Let's bring in our chief foreign correspondent, Ian Pannell, who joins us now. And Ian, you have spent more time in Ukraine than anyone. This is a pretty extraordinary turn of events. How significant do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it is the most significant event since the Russians were forced to withdraw from around the capital, Kyiv, back in April earlier this year. At the time, they talked about it being a reallocation of troops, a regrouping. They're using the same phrases now. This is huge. The amount of territory they've taken is more than 3,000 square kilometers. That's something like over 1,100 square miles in a matter of days.
How did they do it?
A number of factors. I think the key one was the Ukrainians announced that they were going to target their offensive in the south in Kherson, and that led to the Russians pulling a lot of their best forces away from Izium, away from these areas around Kharkiv, relocated them there. So they were vulnerable. They didn't backfill. They didn't have the support there. And the Ukrainians planned. They saw the weakness and they struck.
And the Russians have lost massive amounts of equipment. Their supply lines have broken down because of this. So what do they do now? And what does Vladimir Putin do?
I mean, the options don't look great. I mean, there are very, very few. They're in real trouble right now. They're in defensive positions everywhere because what this offensive means, it doesn't just mean the north of the country. It frees up Ukrainian troops to now push down into Donbass. Remember, we're all talking about the east of the country. All that territory that the Ukrainians had to cede to the Russians, well, now the Ukrainians are on the front foot looking like they may retake some of those key places. We talked about the Russians taking Luhansk, which is one half of the Donbass. Well, now they don't have it anymore. They have the majority of it, but they're still on the back foot. Putin does not have many good options.
We've talked about this over and over again as being a war of attrition. It still is. This does not end anything, do you think?
I mean, on one level it doesn't, but I think what it shows us and what should teach us is it's not a static conflict. It is a war of attrition, but every time one side or another makes a gain, we leap from one direction to the other, saying, oh, well, the Russians are on the front foot, they took the Donbass, the Ukrainians are having real problems. Well, now it looks the other way around. I genuinely believe that Russia has a much bigger problem here. It can't resupply its troops. It doesn't have troop rotations. It's lacking in the equipment and the ammunition. And as I say, they're on the defensive everywhere. The Ukrainians are getting huge help from the United States and other countries, and they know that they've got the momentum on their side.
And Ian, I do want to turn to the death of the Queen. I know you first met her. You told us a wonderful story about first meeting her in 1993 as a very young reporter, I'm sure. And also King Charles, when he was prince, you were in Afghanistan with him. This is really a time of reckoning for him. What do you see?
Yes, I mean, he's got huge shoes to fill. What struck me about meeting the Queen was her ability to put people at ease, to touch everybody, and to kind of fill a room with her presence and kind of sprinkle royal fairy dust, if you like. Charles has got a much bigger problem because he doesn't have the credit in the bank that his mother did, that the Queen did. And he will be under a lot of pressure, a lot of scrutiny in the coming days. But what I learned in Afghanistan is his public figure, he can seem rather aloof, rather stuffy. But actually, when you talk to him, he's very engaged and very engaging. He knows his topic. He's very good at meeting people. Both of his sons served, but he's led a very privileged life, and Britain has changed substantially since when his mother was coronated. He will have to meet that challenge.
Okay, it's always great to see you, Ian Pannell, wherever we are in the world. Much more ahead on Queen Elizabeth's life and legacy as our special edition of This Week Live from London continues.
That was the scene at Ground Zero just a short time ago. It's been 21 years since the 9/11 attacks. Queen Elizabeth once said right afterwards, "Grief is the price we pay for love." That was her message of support after that attack. Let's bring in our roundtable now. Former DNC chair Donna Brazile is with us, New York Times White House and national security correspondent David Sanger, Washington Post political correspondent Mary Jordan, and former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Welcome all. Chris, let me begin with you. We're going to get to politics in just a moment. But Queen Elizabeth, a world leader for so long, but of a very different kind than Americans are used to. No hard power, really, in being a queen. And yet, how do you think she served her country and the world? And what lessons for other leaders are there in the way she did it?
I heard someone say recently, and I agreed with it, she was her nation's mother. And she evolved into that, obviously, over years because she came into the job extraordinarily young because of the premature death of her father. But she provided a sense of stability, a sense of guidance, a sense of calm during some very turbulent times in Great Britain and the world. And so I think that's what she provided. And it's going to be very interesting to see her son. Now, remember, we knew nothing about her when her father died. She was not prepared to be queen. Charles, as you and I were discussing off air, has been preparing for nearly 70 years. And we know everything about him, his broken marriage, his difficulties with his parents and all the rest. Will he be able to be the same type of symbol for Great Britain, or will he have to change? I think that's going to be interesting to watch. Mm.
All eyes on him. And Donna, I was struck this week. She was queen at the time Britain ended its role as a serious colonial power. And like all colonial histories, they've got a tough one. Genuine accomplishments, scarred by crimes as well. And yet, all around the world, ordinary people who used to be her subjects seemed really sad about her departure.
You know, no matter what your beef might be with the monarchy, and the fact that when I hear, even now, watching some of the pictures, her subjects, she was a queen that wanted to be with her people, to be aligned with their values. She understood her duty, her responsibility, and yet at the same time, I think most people would understand that this was a role that she was not in line for, but she took on this responsibility. You know, I think about her as I think about Queen Victoria, because she was strong. She had a sense of history. Imagine meeting 13 U.S. presidents, 15 prime ministers, including now three women. I mean, we haven't had that in America. And five popes. Five. So God bless the Queen. May she rest in peace. May her memory be a blessing. But also, I would hope that King Charles II can rule in a different way.
Third.
Govern. The third?
Right.
He's the third?
He's the third.
See, I don't know all my history, but
Charles
that's
II,
okay.
They,
oh, well.
They asked him.
Let's not do that.
So, Mary, you lived in London, and you got to meet the Queen. I'm going to ask what anyone would ask. What was she like?
I think the part of her that is harder to see is her thriftiness and her mischievousness. So I met her in Buckingham Palace because she invited some Americans over because she was going to America. And she has a special interest in the States. I mean, people will tell you, the diplomats, British diplomats and Americans, that she wanted to know what was going on in Congress. She wanted to know what was going on with Trump and Biden. I mean, she was on the phone asking. So before she came to the United States, she had this little gathering in Buckingham Palace. You know, it's over-the-top, opulent, priceless paintings. And there she is. She's not fancy. She was, you know, this is a woman that uses Tupperware in the kitchen, right? And so that came across. And also, like, you are told, you know, okay, you're going to go up now and you can speak with her. And so we were in this little horseshoe. And who did she go to first? She went to the younger rowers, American rowers who were over there, and said, can I see your hands? Because she's just so down to earth. She wanted to see the calluses because she knew if they were rowers. And there it began. And she, you know, she started laughing, and there was an American guy, and she said, what do you do? And he said, I import waffle mix. And she started laughing. and she just had this little twinkle. I think she's funnier than you think. I think the big challenge for her son is, you know, he's not known to be thrifty, and she is.
And he'll have to be. Well, from Queen Elizabeth, you mentioned the former president, Donald Trump. Let's talk about this search at Mar-a-Lago and all the legal battle that's come out. And Chris, I want to call on your experience on that. The judge in this case, or in the case that the Trump team brought, has appointed a special master to look over all the material that was seized out of Mar-a-Lago. The Justice Department is appealing. And former Attorney General Bill Barr said that that was a deeply flawed ruling. What do you make of it and the Justice Department's chances?
Well, look, I think the Justice Department's chances are pretty good. And I think they are because their main thrust is that some of these may be covered by executive privilege. Well, there's only one executive who can assert the privilege, and that's the one who is the current executive, Joe Biden. A previous executive can't assert his executive privilege. You're not the executive any longer. Biden will not assert executive privilege over these documents. And I think the idea that some of these documents are somehow attorney-client privilege is going to be a bit of a reach. And I think they're going to have to show, in some respect, they have a good faith basis to make that claim. So I think, for one, I think the DOJ probably has a pretty good chance on appeal. But I think we also should take a step back, Terry, because I remember all the hysteria when this first search was first done. And I was on the show saying we should wait and see why DOJ did this. It's not only the nature of the documents. We now have a good idea of the timeline. This has been 16 months that the Department of Justice has been saying please, asking nicely, negotiating with his attorneys, taking a partial production, seeing a non-response to a subpoena. They had no choice, in my view, but to go in and take them, because of the nature of the documents. I'll say one quick note. When you have SCI information, secure compartmentalized information, as the U.S. attorney, when I had to review that in the post-9/11 era, I had to go into a special room called the SCIF to review it. I couldn't take pictures. I couldn't take anything with me. He had that in the top drawer at Mar-a-Lago in his desk. That's a problem. I don't think he'll be prosecuted for it, but we had to get those documents back.
Let's talk about that, David. Few people know more about this area of national security than you. How serious is this? What should ordinary Americans think about the documents that Trump had and the impact that it has on our national security?
Well, the first thing is we've never seen a case before where a president took these documents with them. President Obama, when he was working on his memoirs, had to go ask for documents to be brought over, and they would be, you know, in a special container, and as the governor has said, you know, examined in a SCIF or some secure position. Second, It's the things we don't know right now that actually affect what the national security implications are. There are empty folders that seem to have held classified documents but had no classified documents in them. Were those already given back? Are they elsewhere? Are they on another Trump property? Did they get into the hands of somebody that did not have authority to go see them? Those are all the issues that, as you know, when there are other leaks not involving a president of the United States, there are bipartisan demands for investigation. The other oddity here is the president's, former president's claim, episodic claim, that he declassified all of these, for which there is, right now, no evidence. In fact, on those classified documents they recovered, they still had the cover sheet showing either secret or top secret or SCI, as the governor said. One would think if you went through a declassification process, those would be gone.
Let's talk about the political implications of this, especially after President Biden has made MAGA Republicanism, as he calls it, one of the central focuses of the Democrats' campaign, calling it extremist and a threat to democracy. And here's Donald Trump taking center stage again in some ways with this search and fighting it. Well, is that a good idea for Democrats to fight this on this ground in part?
I think the president is trying to alert the American people that we have a threat, and that threat is the extremism. And the MAGA movement is an extremist movement that embrace conspiracy theories that do not support or adhere to the rule of law.
But is that a winning political argument?
The Democrats have so many things to campaign on. I was looking just the other day, and I'm like, my God, not now. I finally got a whole page, okay? So, yes, we're going to talk about the threats to our democracy. We're going to talk about what the Biden-Harris administration has done to improve American lives, over 9 million jobs created. Everything is on the table, but the MAGA movement is a threat. I don't say Republicans. Chris, you know why? Because you're a common-sense Republican.
You're going to get him in trouble.
No, I'm not. No, you're common sense. Yeah. We don't agree. You and I have differences. But you're not going out there marching up against the Capitol. When you were defeated, you left office.
I mean, I was never defeated, by
no,
the way.
No, but you know what I'm saying. When you ran for the presidency.
Yeah.
The point I'm making is that President Biden did the right thing in calling out these extremists.
What do you think?
I have three things on this. The first is, if the Democrats think that it's a winning argument for them in the midterms to do what the president did during that speech and personally attack the people who have supported Donald Trump, 74 million of them, who voted for him in 2020, as a politician, I say, great, go get him. Go get him, Mr. President. Because what people don't like, Donnie, in politics, and you know this, is people who govern against brand. He ran to be a uniter. He ran and said he was going to bring the country back together, and then he stood on that stage with a blatantly red background, surrounded by Marines, and attacked 74 million people.
You're not a MAGA Republican. Did you feel attacked?
I did, because I voted for Donald Trump in 2020.
All right.
So, you know, I think it was wrong of the president to do that. And I think the last piece of this is that in the end, we see a Republican Party that is evolving. I do. And what matters and what's going to matter here and what the Democrats, who are so concerned about the threat to democracy, the most cynical, horrible thing I've seen is the money they're putting into Republican primaries to try to nominate Republicans who are election deniers. If that's such a threat to democracy, why would you want to make one of those people the final two for the United States Senate?
We've got just a little bit of time, very little bit of time. The most astonishing story of the weekend, Ukraine, the collapse of the Russian forces in the sector in the east.
It's a huge deal.
David,
it's a huge deal. We'll see if it lasts. But the idea that we have Russians retreating, we have this new boost of morale among the troops in Ukraine. They're today, right now, crying in the streets, saying we pushed them back. We got new Ukrainian land. This is what it's going to do for the morale in a bad way to Russia and what it is going to do in a good way for Ukraine is a very, very significant. And, you know, we're talking about what's ahead in England. You know, they need grain. They need this war to stop because the knock-on effects are huge if it ends.
And the Ukrainians, resourceful and brave once again. But what about the Russians? What do they do now? What are the dangers here?
So there is a great opportunity here and a great risk. The opportunity is that for the first time, Zelensky may be in a position, President Zelensky of Ukraine, to get move toward a negotiated settlement to this war. He needed an upper hand to be able to do that and Putin to be willing to do it. The other problem, though, is that Putin himself may overreact to this, and he has at various moments threatened the use of more extraordinary weapons. Yeah.
Gotta go. Thanks to all. We'll have more from Martha Raddatz live in London right after the break. Stay with us.
Even though Queen Elizabeth was 96 years old, the sense of shock at her death is palpable here in London. After these 10 days of mourning pass, a new era begins with new challenges for the UK, America's closest ally. ABC News will have continuing coverage from London all week. Thank you for joining us this morning. We leave you with a final snapshot of Queen Elizabeth's legacy, the monarch who met with 13 sitting U.S. presidents, a signal of that special bond between the two nations.
This dinner is a humbling reminder of the fleeting nature of presidencies and prime ministerships. Your Majesty's reign has spanned about a dozen of each and counting. That makes you both a living witness to the power of our alliance and a chief source of its resilience.
The American people are proud to welcome Your Majesty back to the United States, a nation you've come to know very well. You helped our nation celebrate its bicentennial in 1976. Come here. She gave me a look that only a mother could give a child.
Your Majesty, for generations, our peoples have worked together and fought together, side by side. As democracies, we continue our quest for peace and justice.
She has embodied the spirit of dignity, duty, and patriotism that beats proudly in every British heart.
We have many distinguished visitors here in this city, but never before have we had such a wonderful young couple who so completely captured the hearts of all of us.
I had the opportunity to meet her before she passed, and she was an incredibly gracious and decent woman.
I ask you to join me in a toast to Her Majesty the Queen. To the Queen.